This is Nick Ferrari with a look back at my week on breakfast here on LBC.
This is a strange one. Children aged just three are among a soaring number of young patients at NHS gender clinics. You might have heard us talk about this in our review of the newspapers in the first hour of the show. It's front page of the Daily Mirror. The number of children telling doctors they were born in the wrong body has quadrupled since 2009. One eight-year-old who now lives as a girl called Jessica said, "I didn't want to be a boy." The confused youngsters often suffer distress and are given counselling and support in the transgender units, which they should be done, which of course should be offered. But when you look at the background that's been done by the BBC for a television show here, two of these children were just three, not even school age when they get full counselling support. And experts say better acceptance of gender change and more awareness among the young about exploring their feelings are some of the factors which have led to the number of under 10s being spent to specialist units quadrupling. That's incredible. The child that they're calling Jessica, whose identity is actually being protected, said that while living as a boy, he didn't fit in. Jessica said how going to the toilet at school was a problem because other boys thought he was a girl and didn't want him in the male loo, but using the girls was out of the question. This therefore led to him not drinking any water, so he didn't have to use the toilet, and he waited until he got home. Jessica's... Well, you see, they've identified a mum here, which I don't think we should do. I think we'll just call her mum. Split from the child's dad several years ago, said she's been accused of conditioning her son. Calls have been made to the NSPCC claiming she forced him to live like a girl. Mum is now... Ah, it's not her real name. That makes sense. Okay. Ella, not her name, is now in a long-term relationship with a woman. Right. Right. Called Alexandra. And she's now wondering whether that played a part in Jessica's gender dysphoria. That is the medical term when you have issues with your sexuality. Right, let's speak with Kate, who's in West London, who's a support assistant and works with children and young adults going through transgendering. Hello, Kate.
Good morning, Nick.
How young is the youngest child with whom you've worked?
I work purely with sixth formers.
I've got a note here that says children. My apologies. Okay. By the time someone's in the sixth form, and I'm guessing they're 16, 17 and 18, I would think they do probably have a pretty good sense. What age do you think, having worked with a number of people here, what age do you start to get a clue as to your... sexuality? Sexual choice? What's the expression I should use? Your gender choice?
Gender identity.
Okay, I don't want to say any incorrect or offensive terms.
No, that's okay.
When do you know your gender identity?
Well, as I've said, purely the ones I've worked with have come to me at 16, 17, and this is what they're bringing to us as a sixth form team.
But do they say, I've known since I was five, I've known since I was six, I've known since I was... 10, I mean, I haven't had that yet.
Just at this stage, they're comfortable to bring it to us and say, this is how I'm feeling.
Yeah. All right, let's come at this a different way. Do you think somebody would know at the age of three?
Well, it seems as if they do, from what you've just read out. I haven't read that yet. I only saw the Thoreau programme a couple of nights ago, and I understand from your researcher there was one last night as well. I didn't see that one. I saw the Thoreau one, which had some very young children, didn't it? Well, I think one was five.
Well, okay. We'll come at this a third way. Kate, I respect what you do for young adults, and I think they do need help. I'm telling you, I don't believe a child knows at three its gender identity.
Okay, Nick.
Do you? Not that it matters, but are you a mum? Have you had children yourself?
Most definitely. I've got four daughters.
You've got four daughters. Okay,
I've
fantastic.
I've got four daughters.
Lovely. So you've got good experience of raising children yourself. At the age of three, it wouldn't occur to them whether they're a boy and they want to be a girl or vice versa.
But they're seeing an awful lot around them, Nick. They are exposed to an awful lot of media and...
A three-year-old? What's he or she watching?
They're watching an awful lot.
They're watching Teletubbies or CBeebies or whatever they want. Frozen, I don't know what they're watching. That's what they're watching.
Well, exactly, Frozen.
Right.
You've just named it. Beautiful girls drifting around in gorgeous long dresses. Yes.
What, so a little boy thinks...
Their attention.
A little boy thinks...
We have spoken before about the young
boys. We have, yeah, we did.
Church.
Yeah, we have.
Who wanted to put on the long dresses and the church objected.
Yeah.
And they had an urge then. And I said then, if that's what's floating his boat at that time, he should be allowed to do that.
But
the worst thing you can do is tell him it's wrong, surely. This is wrong, that's wrong.
Kate, but you sound a lovely woman, and you sound very well educated. Please don't try and persuade me a child knows at three that it wants to be a girl and not a boy. Come on.
I'm not, Nick, but you should make your mind up definitely.
But this is dangerous. No. This
you
is dangerous twaddle.
Can I just say the piece you just read out, yeah, that the young boy said to his counsellor this, that and the other. That was pretty articulate.
Yeah, he's not three, he's
10. 3 and 4 year old.
Hang on. He's not three, he's 10.
Oh, he's 10 now?
Yeah, 10 now, yeah.
But he's still using some very together words.
But the process started with him, I think, when he was 8. And we also have the interesting issue, I don't know, and the mum doesn't now know, that the mum, in fact, has started a lesbian relationship.
Yeah, I got that from what you said as well. That's
so I'm not going to dispute that mum wants best for her son, but could it not be that in some instances, a mother who's possibly confused about her own gender identity decides that she has a boy and actually she wanted a girl, or vice versa.
No, hold on. Mum isn't confused about her gender identity.
Sorry, her sexuality. I'm so sorry. Thank you. Sorry, I apologise. I don't want to offend anybody. Yeah, sorry. That's sexuality. Got it. But mum has suddenly decided that, in fact, she's drawn to women. So that could colour, not necessarily in this case, because this child was 8 when they started, but that's going to... We can't allow this happening. This isn't like changing the wallpaper. This isn't like saying, well, I tell you what, I think I'll have some flop wallpaper today. Nah, tell you what, I think I'll have something with a floor, I think I'll have something with birds on it. This is absurd. Okay. We are too... I think I've got you. We are too indulgent, aren't we?
You've got to get me. I'm not going to...
I think
them.
I'm bringing
I'm
you round, Kate. My
you
voice of reason...
Because if one thing I've learnt over the last 7, 8 years is you don't make your mind up definitely, and I think it's terrific that there's another awareness here that if a child is distressed...
Three? Come on.
Nick, let me finish. Hold on. Come on. You've woken me up in half term for this. You know, it's half term. Give me a break.
Go ahead, Kate.
That there's an awareness that if you have a child distress, we are already very well taught what to look out for, signs of distress and safeguarding within education, within right down to nursery schools. If there's another aspect that we have to be aware of, I think that's a good thing. Because I'm having sixth formers, transgender, I've got one recently, cross-dressing, has been able to come to us.
What age?
To the school. 17.
Yeah, that's fine. Well, sorry, when I say that's fine. I get it at 17.
The great thing is
that's
that they're
not
able
three.
To now, I see your point. I do see your point, but surely an awareness. It's going to be a minority, isn't it? But surely
one is too many.
There.
One is too many. One thing, Kate.
Yeah.
It's not half term.
It is half term. Oh, no, you're right. It's a new term starting next week.
It's the Easter holidays, and enjoy. And I hope you had plenty of eggs. And look, good luck to your girls, and give them my regards. And thank you for coming on. Always good speaking with you. Kate from West London, thank you, who is a support assistant working with sixth formers. This is the key here. I don't dispute for a second that a young girl or young boy, 17, I absolutely get it. Three, I just think, pardon my language, is absolute cobblers. Or lack of. Jean's in Bellingham on this. Good morning, Jean.
Hello there. I think it's cobblers too. My mum and dad had 4 of us. There was us 3 girls, and finally my dad got a son, which he really, really wanted.
Oh,
now, I myself, right, was, you know, I felt as if I wanted to be a boy because...
At what age?
Oh, about 5, 6, 7, you know. I mean, I was sort
seven,
of a tomboy.
That's...
I was a tomboy.
Yeah.
And he just wanted a son, and I felt inadequate.
Yeah.
And my sisters did a bit as well, or 2 of us.
Mm.
Because, you know, that was it, you know, he had a son, whoa, whoopee, I've got a son at last, you know,
yes.
And all the focus was on my brother. Of course, I love him, but actually he's died, but anyway.
You so, lost your you brother, know, did you say?
Pardon?
Sorry, did you say you lost your brother, did I hear?
Yeah, I lost my brother in 2011,
oh, God.
3 months before I lost my daughter and my grandson. Anyway, that's awful.
I'm so sorry, it's horrific.
I know, and you're gorgeous for saying so.
I'm just showing human compassion. I mean, that's so much that you've endured. Jean, I'm sorry I've got to get some trouble out there, but I'm very grateful. Do call me again soon, and thank you for your input. There's plenty more. Let's talk non-doms, and let's talk the idea of children aged 3 knowing that they have a gender identity crisis. Bal is in Reading. Do you agree, Bal?
I don't think so. I think whoever's come up with this theory needs to have psychiatric help, because you know, you're born with the right body, but what happens...
No, no, I don't know that you always are, in fairness. I can see by the time you're in your teens, or obviously older, you suddenly realise you wanted to be a woman. In some instances, I don't think it's necessarily perhaps as prevalent as the figures show, but do you not think in some instances there's something there?
No. At the age of three, you barely know...
No, at the age of three. But the age of, say, 23 or 33 or 43, you know, don't you?
Yeah, well, then you're allowed to make decisions. It's just like following any religion. I mean, you know, things like that. You're more aware of what's happening. You're allowed to make your own decisions.
Yeah.
But at the age of three, you know, I don't believe that. You know what I mean? Not for the age of three and age of five. Shouldn't be taught... sex education at 3 years, 5 years, etc., things like that. So basically, it depends on the environment you're being brought up in. That influences you. I think that's more important, I think.
That's really interesting, Val. Thank you. Mark in Tulse Hill. I tried to watch a show by Louis Theroux. Well, our guest mentioned that, didn't he? About transgender children in America. Firstly, I found it depressing. Secondly, I started to think this should not be legal. How can a child make an uninformed decision will affect the rest of his or her life based on what could easily be a phase. If it turns out it's not a phase, so be it, but you really shouldn't be so quick to act on a child's whims. Well, imagine, Mark, a child of three. Child of three? They don't even know whether they like Cocoa Flakes, Corn Flakes or Rice Krispies at that age. They certainly don't know whether they want to be a girl or a boy. It's ridiculous. Jan says, I was aware from the age of five that I wanted to be a girl. I'm now 70 and I'm happy I made the transition. Well, even Jan 5 is not 3. Well done, Nick. Spelling the bleeding obvious.
This is Nick Ferrari with more to come as I look back at my week on breakfast. This is LBC. This is Nick Ferrari with a look back at my week on breakfast here on LBC.
And lots of you want to talk about whether we should raise the legal limit by which you can buy alcohol from 18 to 21. Ponder that. If you do that, you can join the army at 16, get married at 16, pay taxes at 16, you can vote at 18. But this suggestion by NHS Scotland is that you're not old enough or mature enough to drink until you're 21. What do you make of that? 0345 6060 973. Before we get back to your calls on that, front page of the Daily Mirror, hard up patients are increasingly pulling out their own teeth rather than pay for a dentist. NHS surgery shortages and costly bills means a rise in do-it-yourself dentistry with 1,000 using repair kits. According to the Daily Mirror, they say they describe how one Gulf War veteran pulled 13 of his own teeth out with pliers because he can't afford surgery. 56% of people in the Midlands, according to the Mirror, haven't seen a dentist in the past 2 years, partly because of the shortage of NHS dentists. Another one quoted in the Mirror says, I've tried 30 dentists in 8 years, but none are taking NHS patients. Well, I wonder if that's a problem which affects you. Let's talk now to Dr. David Houston, who's an NHS dentist in Weston-super-Mare. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Andrew.
Are they pulling out their teeth in Weston-super-Mare?
Fortunately, I have to say no. It doesn't have. It's not something that's in my personal experience. I have practiced in the town for the last 25 years, and although I am well aware, as most of my profession are, that there is an access issue due to the shortage of funding from government levels at the present time, we seem to be able to satisfy demand in our area, and DIY dentistry isn't something that features large on our daily workload, no.
I mean, are you aware of this, that this is going on in some parts of the country?
Well, certainly one hears anecdotally of bigger issues in access than in our part of the southwest of England, but certainly I have never come across a professional colleague saying to me that they have come across a patient with DIY dentistry issues, no.
What would we hear? People say, oh, I had an NHS dentist and he went private, I had an NHS dentist and he went private. And Nigel Nelson, who was with me earlier in the previous hour, he's the political head of the People, he said a lot of NHS dentists did not like the contracts they got under the last government, so have opted to go into the private sector. And of course, when we talk about NHS, we talk about hospitals and GP appointments, you dentists are often overlooked in that.
Yes, we are. That's true, Andrew. I mean, in 2006, a new contract was presented to the dental profession. Possibly, it could be said, without very much consultation and without very much notice. and a great many of my profession did not like the nature and tone of that contract, felt it was going to restrict their ability to treat their patients in the way that they would wish, and certainly in the way that patients had been accustomed to prior to the 2006 contract change, and therefore that was a very large stimulating issue for making many of my profession go into the private sector, sadly a great many of whom who have not returned. However, the government was under an obligation to find patients access to alternative care, and the budget was allocated to other practices. So although the budget may not have grown since 2006 in real terms, particularly because of the economic situation, the same level of access should still be there. But by the very nature of it, obviously patients' access wishes to be increased because the population has increased in 2006, where many of the issues are coming from, I suspect.
Yeah, according to Health Watch England, some patients are travelling up to 40 miles to find an NHS dentist. That's pretty poor, particularly if you're a pensioner or a mum with a pushchair.
It is categorically not a situation that my profession or its representatives would wish to be the case. It's something that we've campaigned for, we've asked for greater access, we've asked for increased funding. But of course, dentistry is a bit of a Cinderella subject.
Yeah.
And it is not something that gains a lot of votes for politicians, I don't think. It's not a very emotive issue until something like this story comes along. So sadly, we are often overlooked, as you've already said earlier in the interview.
If I could just ask you finally, Dr. Houston, if I was to come to your surgery and have a check-up and then a filling, what would that cost me?
£51.30 is the standard charge on the NHS for that at the current time, Andrew. £18.80 for your check-up, and if the filling had to be done at the same time, it would increase the charge to what's called a band 2 to £51.30.
And if I had to have a tooth out?
Same, £51.30 is a standard NHS charge for what's called a band 2 treatment, which that would come under.
Okay, that's Dr. David Houston. He's an NHS dentist in Weston-super-Mare. He sounds very nice, doesn't he? Which is what you want with a dentist, because it can be a little bit intimidating. Talking of dentists, John's rang from Eastbourne. Good morning.
Yeah, good morning, Andrew. I think the main problem about all this, really, is in, say, the last 40 years, there's been incredible advancements in medical science, and yet, From what you're discussing now, it seems like we're going back to the dark ages when it comes to dental care. I mean, the only people, anyone that's in a working job nowadays that goes to a dentist and pays for their treatment, goes in fear of what kind of bill they're going to get. You know, it's a sad thing to say, the only people that can go to a dentist these days to get whatever treatment they require and not worry about the bill are people actually on benefits that don't pay for the treatment.
Well, how often do you go to a dentist, John?
Well, funny enough, I've got to go next week for a check-up, and I must admit, every single time I go, obviously, the pressure's always on to try and go private, you know, because obviously I'm getting to the age now when I do perhaps need implants and things like that. But if I was to go down that road, the cost of having that done to me would run into thousands, you know, which I would like to have done. But obviously I'm not in a position to want to spend £10,000 on my teeth, you know?
No. Do you get scared about going in a dentist chair, John?
I don't get scared. I would like to have better dental health than what I've got, and I think that is a terrible part about it. I mean, if I had to go into hospital for, say, a major operation that might cost perhaps the NHS £25,000, I would be entitled to have that done under NHS care, whereas if I want to get good dental hygiene in my mouth and have a good set of teeth, obviously I'm restricted to do that unless I was on benefits or if I was rich enough to pay for it.
All right, John. Well, good luck with the dentist next week. That's John in Eastbourne. Lee's in Middlesex. Morning, Lee.
Oh, yes, good morning. I had a dental appointment. I actually live in Kent. I'm staying with my daughter in Middlesex at the moment. I had a dental appointment in Kent where I needed work done and I needed a new plate, a partial plate, and the cost altogether was £200. Unfortunately, I had a fall, broke my hip, and had to have a hip replacement. The first thing I did was call the dentist to say, look, I can't come. I've got to be, you know, sit on certain height chairs, etc., for a certain length of time. But as soon as I get back to Kent, I'll call you and come and pick up this partial plate. I then got a call back from the dentist saying, look, I'm sorry, this is not the dentist calling. This is the NHS is saying this. If you do not pick up your plate by a certain date, you will possibly have to pay another £200, which means, although I'd paid everything first, that this partial plate is going to cost me £400. I broke my head, for heaven's sake, you know. I'm not doing it just for the love of it or for a lark. And I just don't know where to go from here. And it seems very, very unfair.
Yeah, and that's a lot of money. Can you afford £400?
Well, yes, I could afford it, but why should I have to? I've paid it.
Of course you have.
Up. Yeah. I paid it on the day. I said, let me pay it now. I had the choice. Pay it or then, or pay it when I picked it up. Sorry, I'm sounding really indignant. I'm not. I'm very nervous.
You're allowed to be indignant, Lee. We don't mind that.
Yeah. I mean, when I go home, I'm going to ring my dentist, going to say, give me an email address for the NHS or give me a phone number, and I'm going to fight this because I think it's ridiculous.
Does seem a bit strange. Lee, best of luck with your fight, and don't be nervous. We like people calling in indignant on LBC, any emotion you like. I'm going to the dentist on Friday too. I've got to that age now where I'm apparently grinding my teeth at night, grinding them away, so I'm going to go and have a plate fitted. How romantic is that? But of course, that's private, because honestly, I haven't had an NHS dentist for probably 15 years. They just vanished. And I had a problem, and I wanted to get my tooth sorted, so I went private, and I've been in the clutches of private dentist ever since. What's your experiences with the NHS and dentists, I wonder? And I still want to talk to you about alcohol. Should we raise the age by which you can buy alcohol legally from 18 to 21? That's the proposal from a health body, which says it's the only way to tackle binge drinking. Lots of you calling in about alcohol and whether we should raise the legal age by which you can buy alcohol to 21. You'd have heard in the bulletins that UKIP has claimed a Conservative parliamentary candidate has defected to them. Mike Whitehead, who's standing in Hull West and Hessle. Nigel Farage, the UKIP leader, says his defection is a hammer blow to Tory pretensions in the north of England. But the Tories say Mr. Whitehead was sacked as a candidate last week for refusing to support local Conservative council candidates. It does strike me, reading between the lines, that this is a local dispute that's blown up in the Conservative faces. But it is, the headline is for UKIP, because this candidate has defected to UKIP in the parliamentary election in a few weeks' time.
This is Nick Ferrari. More highlights of my week on breakfast after the news. This is LBC.
This is LBC. He's back.
Why should Abbas, the last caller, apologise for what these murderers in Paris did?
Well, because I think the alternative is that there is no apology. Well,
have you apologised yet?
Apologise for what?
With the murders in France on Wednesday.
Why would I need to apologise for that?
Well, why does Abbas? He was in Berkshire. Tell me why you haven't apologised for the shoe bomber whose name was Richard, because Abbas has to apologise for a terrorist who said he was a Muslim. You're allowed to admit you've made a mistake, my friend.
James O'Brien returns to weekday mornings, Monday from 10, only on LBC.
This is Nick Ferrari with a look back at my week on breakfast here on LBC.
Desperately upsetting story, this heartbreaking, particularly when you see a picture of the little tot staring out from the papers at you. A schoolgirl who scored a string of A stars at GCSE hanged herself weeks after sitting her exams, following her failure to come to terms with a diagnosis of mild autism. Just mild autism. This was heard at an inquest. We're talking about Elspeth McKendrick, who was 16. She'd wanted to fit in at school and built up a circle of friends. But she felt alone after doctors told her she had Asperger's syndrome. And while it is reported and the inquest heard that she was happy to be seen as odd and mildly eccentric, she was upset at the diagnosis and then felt unable to tell anyone of her feelings about it. Last August, of course I remind you this was heard in an inquest, that's why there's been a time slip, a week after going on a school trip as part of the National Citizen Service, oh dear, the teenager was found hanged in her bedroom after leaving a note apologising to her family and telling how she wished she could have been able to open up to friends. Oh, this is awful. The inquest was heard in Heywood in Greater Manchester, and they were told that Elspeth, who lived in Bury, had been an artistic and creative pupil at the Tottington High School and indeed was a prefect. She was an avid reader. She always had a novel in her school bag. She'd won a place at Manchester College of Art to study for A-level. She was a very bright young girl. Her mum, gosh, what's she going through? Rebecca Jackson, who The Daily Telegraph informs us this 47 said she'd told a problem socialising and making close friends. Although she had a lot of friends, she also wanted to have a close best friend, and she didn't have that. There were behavioural issues and tantrums that were beyond my experience of normal teenage tantrums, because for Elspeth, things were black and things were white. She was very tech savvy. She enjoyed using the computer. It caused an awful lot of problems. We'd sometimes get woken up in the middle of the night at 2, and she was on the computer, or at 4, and then not sleeping. She was existing on 4 hours a night. It was Elspeth's way or the highway. Dear, oh dear. Her father, Ewan, who's 43, said she was not happy about her diagnosis. She wanted to be Elspeth and felt the diagnosis was a waste of time. She felt she was being observed. Assistant Coroner Catherine McKenna recorded a conclusion of suicide. So, coping with and living with, I remind you, as I said just before the news, one of my colleagues, I asked them to dig out, because I knew that there are many people who've, not just high achievers, phenomenally high achievers, who've had some form of these conditions. Well, I mean, where do you end them and where do you start? Michelangelo, Mozart, George Orwell, Henry Cavendish, Hans Christian Andersen, Albert Einstein, for goodness sake, Alfred Hitchcock, Isaac Newton, Bill Gates, even Susan Boyle. Let's talk with Helen Dyer, who's director of CASPA, Children on the Autistic Spectrum Parents Association. Your heart must be broken when you hear a story like this. Good morning.
Morning, Nick. Yeah, what a shame. First of all, obviously, I'd like to send my sincerest apologies to the family of Elspeth. Mm. Yeah, it's not too much of a surprise to me.
In what way?
Well, we work with around 200 families a week within the Bromley area who have children who have either a diagnosis of autism spectrum disorder or similar social and communication difficulty, or who are fighting to get their child's difficulties recognised and diagnosed, which is obviously one of the sad things about this, is the families fighting to get their child's support.
Why is it such a fight, situation. Helen? Why is it such a fight, Helen?
Oh, that's an interest. Well, I guess especially when you read, you know, when you were reading out about Elspeth and her strengths, it's a difficult thing to identify whether a young person who's high functioning, who's academically capable, who seems to be socially clinging on in there, has what would be regarded as a disability, which would need specific support. So a lot of parents have to fight for that kind of recognition. Yeah.
What is the
quite late.
We'll talk about the children in a second. What is the biggest challenge for the parent, the mum and or the dad of a child diagnosed?
That's a difficult one because do you mean before diagnosis or after?
No, after diagnosis. What level? What? How do they give support?
How do the parents give support?
Yes.
Well, I would hope that the parents themselves would be getting support from somebody like, you know, from an organisation like CASPA to then structure things within the home so that it reduces the anxiety and the stress for the young person and therefore reduces the negative behaviours. It is the behaviours that obviously, like you just kind of referred to within the article, that the parent struggles with.
Yes.
Really, the extreme behaviours.
Why have you got involved in this?
Well, my background's in theatre, actually, not in autism, but I started doing some workshops with CASPA 12 years ago and met some phenomenal young people. And actually, one of the things that turned me off of doing whatever I was doing before and to build this charity and now obviously becoming the director is the fact that these young people have such a unique set of needs that are not being catered for in many, many places, and I can see a difference that could be made, and it's a lifelong intervention, and I know that we can do that successfully.
In this young woman's case, she talked about how she had some friends, but she desperately wanted a close friend, a best friend. How difficult is it for children with these conditions to make a very close friend, a sort of intimate friend, a best chum?
I would say it's extremely difficult.
Why?
From the experiences that we have. It's because of the way that the autistic brain works can sometimes mean that the appropriateness of even opening conversations, maintaining conversations, maintaining communication, understanding what the other person needs from you or wants from you, how to give them that, it becomes so much more difficult than a neurotypical person, teenager, who can read signs, who can communicate appropriately, who can understand their own emotions maybe a little bit better. there are many barriers for our young people.
So if someone's listening now who senses that perhaps someone is trying to reach out to them and might have some form of Asperger's or something and wants to make them a friend, what should they do? How is the best way to approach this, someone who's not got any skill set in this area?
It's just about being open. I was talking to a group of young people yesterday who came to do some work with our young people, our autistic young people, and I said to them, put aside their autism, don't see them as disabled, see them as human beings, look at them, think about what they might need in that moment, and just be open to giving it to them. And if you don't understand what's going on, turn to one of us, and we'll help you to do that. Because it's a case of, just like this young lady, she was happy to be odd, or known as odd and mildly eccentric. This is something that comes through with our teenagers a lot. They're happy to be different as long as they're accepted and that their strengths are celebrated and they're not seen as less than.
And some of those strengths are truly incredible when you look at the list of people. Thank you. That's Helen Dyer, Director of CASPA, C-A-S-P-A, CASPA, Children on the Autistic Spectrum Parents Association, operating in Bromley and the surrounding areas of Kent and south-east London. I go through this list again. Henry. Hans Christian Andersen, Henry Cavendish, Charles Darwin, Jim Henson, the Muppets creator, George Orwell, Mozart. I mean, these are incredible list of people. But if you have the condition, if someone you know, you love your child, coping with Asperger's or autism, this poor girl who just couldn't cope. Mandy's in Dartford. Mandy, well, how does this affect you? Good morning.
Hello. I've got two sons with Asperger's.
Oh, yes.
And they're both on, like, a sick... They both have it in different ways.
Right.
One used to get it aggressively, but we got anger management for him, and that helped him through.
Right.
And one gets it where he's a bit inverted. But what I've always taught my two sons is it's a hidden ability, not a disability.
Yes.
Because they can do some amazing things that I could only dream of, and it's fascinating.
Tell me in what way it's fascinating, and explain that to my listeners, please.
Basically, my middle son, when he's looking at football scores, he can remember every single match from the last 10 years.
No. What? Do you mean involving his team, or any team?
Any team.
What, so I could ask him Leicester versus West Bromwich Albion in 2005 and he'd know the score?
He'll remember it, and it's quite handy because we do predict the score and it's won us money.
How much has it won you?
£900.
How much?
£900, because we say to him, what match was that? And we use it to predict the next match.
What's he doing next Friday for a pub quiz? How old is the boy?
He's 18, he's had many difficulties going through school, but he can do numbers like anything. He does Pythagoras theorem without using a calculator. He does it in his head.
You say all of this, there'll be parents thinking, well, this young man's set for life. He can pretty much do whatever he wants. And I'm not being rude, but does he have social skills? Please don't think I'm being rude, but does he have social skills as well?
He has social skills, and writing was incredibly difficult. Social skills, the eye contact and things. But what you do, any opportunity to get help, you go for it.
Mm.
Because then they become rounded individuals and they cope. Like, for having a cuddle, he finds difficult. But he's got... It's how he's become. But my eldest has got it. He used to be quite aggressive. And he'd get up in the middle of the night on a computer. He joined the poker site without us knowing. We had to sort that out. But he used to be very aggressive. I mean, he's knocked out windows, things like that. But now he's 22.
Now another parent is listening saying, that's not a great, that's just a badly disciplined boy. How would you respond?
No, because he couldn't explain emotion and everything. And
respectfully, that's any teenage boy.
Come on,
I've had teenage boys. I wouldn't say they're crash odd at emotion, are they?
No, it was from the age of 9.
Oh, okay.
He couldn't explain his emotion.
Yeah.
And the anger management, they taught him how to explain it.
Right.
He did everything we could. He's now 22 and a manager in a pharmaceutical company.
Oh, that's...
Not proud.
Oh, I tell you what, for all the challenges and the trials, you wouldn't swap them for the world, would you?
No, because they have overcome difficulties.
Yeah.
And I've said to them both, I said, when I'm old and grey, just shove me in a home, you've got to live your own life. And they both said, oh, no, we're having you. No way would we let you go in a home and all this.
That's nice.
have learnt the compassion. They don't have it instinctively.
No.
They've learnt it.
Can't you get a lot of money on the pub quiz circuit? They must have pub quizzes in Dartford. You could go around making a fortune with him, that lad.
Oh, I'm just proud of him.
Of course,
I mean, it's taken him many times for him to do his GCSE English because his English skills are behind the comprehension of that. But when he did it, we took him out for a meal because, like I said, you've got to treat it as a hidden ability, not a disability.
Mm.
When you pander to it like that, it is the most negative way, and you can't put Asperger's in the same box. They all have it completely differently.
Mandy, lovely story. Look after them. Thank you.
This is Nick Ferrari with more to come as I look back at my week on breakfast. This is LBC. This is Nick Ferrari with a look back at my week on breakfast here on LBC.
Picture of the in the Sun newspaper today of the airline crew that lost their, who lost their lives in that tragedy with the German Wings Airbus last month. There were six of the crew and 144 passengers, so the total deaths, isn't it horrific, just so you go through those numbers again, 150. So the German Wings HQ, of course it's part of Lufthansa, the German Wings HQ in Cologne, they've set up a shrine to the crew. And there are two air stewardesses, if they're still called that, two air stewards, the pilot, Patrick Sondenheimer, and the co-pilot. And each of them is in silver-framed photographs, black and white photographs, in silver frames, with candles burning by each of their photographs. But what the hell is the co-pilot, Andreas Lubitz, doing in that shrine? He's the killer. We now know, and you might recall last week we discussed that the voice recordings and some of the video footage that appears to have emerged. There are question marks about it. But everyone, obviously there are still inquiries going on, but it seems pretty conclusive that Lubitz had some kind of mental episode or whatever it was and decided to end his life, which is very sad. But which is unforgivable is he took 149 innocent people with him. So I can understand that German Wings, the company that owned the plane, want to commemorate and honour the crew that lost their lives, but the co-pilot? Imagine if you were the son or daughter of one of these staff and you went to see a picture of Daddy or Mummy, in the, presumably in the window of the office, I don't know where it is, it's just a photograph of the shrine, and there's the man who killed your mother or your father. What's his picture doing there? Captain Janet Alexander is an airline pilot and joins me now. Do you think the airline have perhaps taken a misstep here, Captain?
Well, I am struggling a little with this one, I have to say. I suppose I can see sort of slightly two sides of it in that, you know, he's a human being, died in terrible circumstances. And as the other aspect of it is, when you fly with a crew, you are a crew. You know, you are, if you like, sounds a bit sort of corny, but united as one, you know, to conduct the flight. And from a Christian perspective, possibly, you know, they'd reach forgiveness. On the other hand, I entirely see what you just said,
yes.
And I too find it very hard to forgive, just on the basis that from a pilot point of view, he's betrayed the trust of our passengers,
yes.
Which is what it's all about. So I am struggling a little with this one, I've got to say.
He's betrayed the trust, Captain, and he's taken 149 innocent souls to their end.
Yeah.
Five of whom his co-crew.
Yeah.
Hmm.
So there's my I am struggling a little with this one, I have to say.
Okay. Overall, had you been involved in this in any way, shape or form, if you were in senior management of the airline and they turned to you and said, look, this is a bit tricky, we've got these photos, we don't know whether to include the co-pilot or not, yes or no, Captain, what would you, and you really, you can't sort of half have the picture in, it's either got to be there or not be there, what would you think you would have done?
From a personal point of view,
mm-hmm.
I'd have said no. But that's a personal view. As a corporate view, I just don't know, and I'm glad it wasn't my decision to make.
Captain, thank you. Captain Janet Alexander is an airline pilot. She captains planes such as the Boeing 737, which is the similar sort of capacity and crew and passengers as the one that crashed so tragically last month. So, over to you. And there's no ifs or buts here. There's a shrine being put together. They've got the photographs. I would think possibly they're their employment pictures. They're very tastefully done in silver frames, all black and white shots. One pilot, four stewards and stewardesses, or air crew, whatever you call them, and, of course, the co-pilot. Would you put that co-pilot there? Yes or no? We'll take your views on that in just a second. Now, I'm interested to get back into that story we were looking at about the man who was stopped by police because he dared to take photographs of a couple of police vehicles. Emma says, my partner is a police officer, and at the moment the threat level is probably the highest it's ever been, and the intelligence leads to the kidnap or murder of police officers and PCSOs. It would much rather a better safe than sorry attitude than the constant worry and strain I know the service is under. No one can say how these things start, so prevention is better than cure. Really, Emma? One man with a mobile phone taking a picture of a police van? Really? Barry says, I was filming a wedding in a square in St. Petersburg in Russia when a police car pulled up. My camera was snatched. Only thanks to my interpreter did I finally get it back, but even then the policeman wanted money. Well, fortunately, we haven't descended to that level, have we? Let's talk to John in Eastbourne. That picture of the co-pilot, yes or no?
Definitely no, Nick. I think it's an unbelievable crest decision for German Wings to include the picture of the co-pilot. I mean, obviously, German Wings were sadly lacking in looking after their passengers by even having this guy flying in the plane to start with.
Mm.
And I think, obviously, as you say, really, it's an added insult to the victims to include the man's picture. They aren't just unbelievable bad decision.
Yeah, I think if a parent or a child or a loved one, husband, wife, went along and saw a picture of their loved one, and there is the man who killed them, it's just insensitivity to an extraordinary degree.
It's unbelievable, Nick. Mm. It really is. I mean, I think if anyone went to that shrine, the first thing they would do was probably to try and remove the picture, I should think, which would be the most sensible thing, wouldn't it?
Yeah, I think I have to agree with you. Thank you for that. Let's see what Bernard in Hackney... Bernard, do you agree he shouldn't have his photograph there?
I really don't know. But like I just said to you, one of your producer people... Obviously, he was suffering from a mental illness.
I don't care. He's a killer. What is this excuse culture for everything, whether you're 32 stone or whether you fly a plane into the cliffs? I don't care. There's something called personal responsibility here, Bernard.
So how do you cope with mentally ill people, a man walking down the street all of a sudden he decides he's going to...
Well, as long as he's not flying aircraft... Look, as long as he's not got himself to 32 stone and I'm paying for his takeaways, or he's not flying aircraft into rocks, we'll do what we can for him.
No, I suppose you're quite right, but you can't account for mental illness, unfortunately.
I know, but you can't allow this man to, I believe, this killer, this killer to be at the same level.
No. Probably not, but maybe they should have had his picture in a different position. I mean, I don't know. But he, if they're going to put his picture on at all, maybe he was in the wrong position. I don't know. But I blame him, and it was a great tragedy. But, you know, man was sick. Man was ill. You don't kill 149 people if you're not mentally ill.
All right, thank you for that. Let's come back to... We talked a little bit about obesity there. Let's come back to that. Michelle is in Birmingham. You're on the radio, Michelle. What can you tell me?
Good morning, Nick. Thanks for taking my call.
Thank you.
I've just got a flip side to it, really. I'm a fitness instructor. I work full-time, first of all, and then part-time I'm a fitness instructor to top up my income. My job as a fitness instructor is to try and get people fit, keep them in shape, keep them healthy, etc. Yet, when I'm injured and I try and get a scan on my knee, I injured my knee a few weeks ago, tried to get a scan, and the GP told me no. Yet, what sort of annoys me is that this girl has inflicted this upon herself.
Mm-hmm.
She's now 32 stone, and she's going to have access to an array of different types of help and treatment from the NHS that I can't get myself. And I'm working. I'm a full-time person, working full-time.
But how ridiculous is that? That's the way the system works. It shouldn't be like this.
It's absolutely a disgrace. It really, really just annoys me. And I think they should cut her benefits. I don't think she should get nothing completely, but I think they should drastically reduce them and top it up with her going to work. Maybe subsidize, have her work, I don't know, 10 hours a week maybe.
I bet you can't afford a takeaway every night.
I can't, Nick.
No,
I honestly can't afford petrol support. To be honest, the money that I get from my fitness instructor work
go straight into the petrol tank.
Yeah.
Because it's just enough to get me from gym to gym.
Yeah.
And it just annoys me that there's no sort of, where's my benefit? Where's my sort of incentive? And where's my thank you for keeping hundreds of people fit each week? Where is that for me? Yet this lady, you know, is allowed to eat herself to the size of the house. She can get all the treatment that she needs.
And we give her the thick end of £19,000 into the bargain. UKIP, they're talking defence, and let's speak with Gerard Batten, who's UKIP MEP for London. And what will UKIP be saying about defence later today, Mr. Batten? Good morning.
Good morning. Well, I understand that Nigel Farage and our defence spokesman, Mike Hookham, will be making speeches this afternoon at about 2:30, so I can't second-guess exactly what they're going to say. I haven't seen the speech, but I can guess what they're going to say is that we would meet the NATO target of 2% of GDP on defence spending. Our defences are the lowest that they've ever been in terms of the numbers of our soldiers and sailors, airmen and service women in ships and planes. Indeed, if the Falklands was invaded tomorrow, there's absolutely nothing we could do about it. What we also want to do is to commit to looking after our ex-service personnel, who very often are in dire circumstances. We want to put in measures in place so that we actually help those people in terms of guaranteed jobs after they've served a certain number of years in the armed forces, for example, in back up to the police, prison service, on UK border force. And I also would like to see some preference in terms of housing and benefits for people who've actually served their country.
You talk about the commitment, which is the NATO guideline, indeed NATO request. Surely it's how you spend the money there that's already there. It's spending wisely rather than just having a set amount of money flooding in every year.
Well, that's true, but we have to spend the money that we've got wisely, and procurement is a big issue with the armed forces, always has been, that we do it properly. But we haven't got enough money because we've got one aircraft carrier on track, but it's not going to have any planes on it till about 2020, so I believe. We've got the lowest number of planes, the lowest number of ships, the lowest number of personnel. So we obviously haven't got sufficient money to do the things that we're committing to. Our armed forces are stretched to breaking point in the different theatres that they're deployed in. You know, they leave is a problem, fatigue is a problem, lack of resources is a problem. So we know we're not spending enough. If we're not going to have a defence presence in the places that we want it, that's fair enough, let's not have it. But if you're going to have it, you've got to fund it properly.
Just lastly, Mr. Batten, why has the wind come out of UKIP's sails of late? Why is the popularity of the polls starting to drop so markedly?
Follow that. I'm looking at the polls on Sky. I was looking at over the weekend. They range from anything up to 12% to 17%, 18%. Depends.
No, you were regularly at 18%, and you mentioned 12. There's one actually I can take you a little bit lower to 10. You were regularly punching 18. Do you think, in fact, as we get closer to it, as the Prime Minister says in an interview today, people will come, come home to the Conservative Party?
Well, I think it depends what poll you're looking at. It depends what the question was that asked. And, of course, the only poll that matters is the one on the 7th of May.
This is Nick Ferrari. More highlights of my week on breakfast after the news. This is LBC.
On FM, online, on your mobile and on digital radio. Leading Britain's conversation. This is LBC.
This is Nick Ferrari with a look back at my week on breakfast here on LBC.
How many of you remember that a little while ago we gave a total of £16 million to some British detainees in Guantanamo because, in the view of the government, they said it was probably cheaper to do that rather than take on each case. One of the recipients, he got £1 million, was Jamal, although it's widely reported it's £1 million, neither party can actually ever fully disclose, but it's been written that it's £1 million and he's not sued. Jamal Kayemba, who's 36, he spent 4 years in the high-security US jail after he was picked up on Pakistan's Afghan border in 2002. Security services claimed he was trying to join the Taliban in the aftermath of 9/11. Now, following his release without charge, the Ugandan-born, British passport-holding Muslim convert, who'd lived in London since his teens, was banned from coming to the country. But the government gave him a seven-figure settlement, £1 million, after he claimed his human rights were abused which, by the way, MI5 and MI6 still dispute. Helping him on his way was CAGE. You may recall that's that human rights organisation. You heard about them earlier this year, when it was discovered that they'd worked with Jihadi John, real name Mohammed Mwazieh, who came to them complaining that he was being harassed by MI5, and they supported his claims. 16 British Guantanamo Bay detainees were settled, a total of that money that I talked about. Now, on Tuesday, Kayumba, who was described in his files in Guantanamo as an admitted jihadist, was among four people seized in a suburb of the Kampala, the Ugandan capital, by US counter-terrorism team. One of the country's chief prosecutors, Joan Kagezi, was shot dead as she prepared to open the trial of Islamic extremists accused of killing 76 people. Now, after his 2002 arrest, Kayembe said he'd gone to Pakistan to study Arabic and to read the Quran. So, what are you going to go to Pakistan to do that? You can get a Quran here in England, and you can study Arabic. We've got colleges you can do it in probably every city of the country. He said he was there for 2 months before being flown to a US prison at Bagram in Afghanistan, where he was, he claimed, subjected to torture and confessed to be left alone. It was extraordinary. Before being transferred to Guantanamo later that year. Once free, he used human rights laws to make claims against British security services. And that's how he and 16 others enjoyed payouts of more than £16 million. Now, as I say, it's always been hotly disputed whether or not he actually was the victim of torture or whether he was the victim of any others of rendition, but we paid the money. And now I appreciate that he's only been caught up in, there's no prosecution yet and as yet uncharged, but why on earth did the government ever leave itself open to doing that? It's still disputed whatever he claims by the services in Britain. He came here as a teenager. Britain, which has a long and enviable tradition and history of offering refuge to people, we gave him refuge. He came here, and he repaid that by deciding to try to sign up with fanatics who'd flown planes into buildings in New York and in Washington, and also clearly sought to bring about as much damage, danger and possibly destruction in the West as possible. The government never allowed those claims to be put before a court. They thought it would be too lengthy, too costly, and also it could compromise national security. So the lawyers to the government suggested it was cheapest and best just to pay them all off. And now this man, who took £1 million worth of our cash to go and live in, I imagine, Uganda, that's where he was arrested, I don't know, perhaps he was just there anyway, possibly in connection with the shooting of a Ugandan judge. Look, this can never be allowed to happen again. This craven, this refusal to stand up for any form of rights. Is this man guilty? Nobody knows. Has he been charged? Not yet. But there starts to build a pattern about this individual, doesn't there? That he decides, after the 9/11 killings, that he wants to go off and study the Quran and learn Arabic. That he decides he wants to try and join the Taliban in Afghanistan. That then, after pocketing £1 million, and how much would, what will that buy you in Uganda, dear God? It probably buys you half the country. He goes down to Uganda and now gets arrested in connection with the killing of this judge. Do you, like me, we've just talked in the previous hour about how the government, not the government, I'm so sorry, about how the government could benefit from the discovery by oil companies of tens of billions of pounds worth of oil under the ground in Sussex. Tens of billions of pounds worth. Now, you know that the government's going to find a way to get at their hands on some of that. The tax take on that would be phenomenal. We cannot continue to just cravenly bow at every opportunity whenever any of these people say that they've been mistreated. We seem to feel, if we don't have a human rights organisation that is in some way funded by you and I, then we actually write checks to these people. And personally, I have had enough. If you want to come to this country, if you want to come and embrace what it is to be British, if you want to contribute and put the job together and raise your family, that is fantastic. I wish you nothing but the best of fortune. Live by the laws, pay your taxes, we'll do everything we can. If you decide you come here, we give you comfort and succour from your teenage years and then decide it would be a good idea to join the Taliban. Not only should we not be paying you, we should just boot you out of the country. You're not born here, you've just got here by living here. We can take that citizenship away like that, and I suggest we do. 13 minutes after 8, let's get some of your views on that. Is it Noosh in Bromley? Good morning.
Yeah, good morning. Hi, I'm originally from Uganda.
Oh, right.
And, yeah, apparently Uganda has been voted as in the safest city in actually Africa, according to CNN.
Right.
Now, today, from what I know, the president has a zero tolerance for terrorism.
Right.
And there's so much alert because of Al-Shabaab. It's around the area.
Yes.
Near Somalia and Kenya.
Yes.
Now, the reason this guy has been arrested is because of that intelligence around. There's so many informers around.
Yes.
And this guy got away with it in Britain because Britain is soft. Britain doesn't want to be held accountable. All they think coming hard on these guys is going to make them, well, brand them wicked.
Yes.
In Uganda, it is so tough, and I'm sure if no one interferes, if no international organization interferes, this guy is going to be taken down. And that's why prisons in Uganda are not the ones like in Britain or America. I mean, when you go to prison, 20 years is 20 years. There is nothing like serving 10. So I'm so glad this guy has been captured. They should let the Ugandan, you know, government deal with it, and no one should interfere. Because, pardon?
Can I just ask you, as you say you're from Uganda, you've talked briefly about how Britain deals with it as opposed to Uganda. How would the average Ugandan view Britain and the way that it treats terror suspects?
Because, to be honest with you, some things are really clear-cut. Why would they let people on the loose just like that? Because they don't want to come hard on them.
Yes.
And then you just had on, you know, hand out cash willy-nilly. You know, this guy's in Uganda. He's enjoying the cash. I mean, £1 million is in Uganda is just, it's just massive amount of, it's so much money. Probably he's used that money to actually do more terrorism.
Well, we better be careful there. We don't know that at the moment. He's not been charged. But listen, speaking as someone, how long have you been here then? How long have you been living in England from Uganda?
I've been here about 16 years now.
Okay.
Because I got married here. But £1 million in Uganda is so much money.
Yes. Well, it's £1 million in Britain is a lot of money. But I know what you're saying. The average wage will be so much lower in Uganda. So it would probably be akin to having about 50 million in Britain. I do understand. Your view, Ahmed?
Good morning.
Hello, sir.
Thank you for taking the call. Yes. This is really making me angry. And I think most, ordinary law-abiding citizens in the country.
Yep.
That, you know, we are treating these terrorists, religious terrorists, majority of them are Muslim, unfortunately, with the kid gloves.
And how should we treat them, Ahmed?
Well, you know, we should really seriously take them to task. If they are caught, with evidence that they have been involved in terrorism, hate preaching.
Well, he said, and we amazingly believed it, that he just wanted to go there. He didn't want to join the Taliban. He wanted to read the Quran.
Well, Nick, the thing is, the only one who benefits from this sort of soft touch approach to these terrorists is the terrorists and the lawyers who defend the indefensible all the time.
I think
on technicalities, this is just beyond belief.
I think a lot of people
trouble for the future in our country.
I think a lot of people would agree with that, Ahmed. I will finish there to get others involved. Kevin's in Hatfield. You're on the radio. Kevin, go ahead.
Morning, Nick. First time caller. Great show, as
Thank
always.
You. How kind.
Just taking the comment that Ahmed was talking about, a law-abiding citizen. I've been in the UK for 5 years on a working visa.
Mm-hmm.
And every time I need to extend my visa, I need to pay to extend the visa. I've got a young family, and we are paying around $8,500 I need to pay before July to extend my visa.
Uh-huh.
Right? And I don't see the balance with the Human Rights Act in the UK, balancing with the immigration that's around.
No.
How the system is fair. You know, I need to work
well,
harder.
Well, it's not, mate.
I need to work harder to find $8,500 just with two babies with me.
Yeah.
And they are not using the system. So how can we have a human rights act in the country or been...
Well, it's not, is it? You're giving all those thousands of pounds, and yet someone who we can certainly say has danced on the edges of terrorism, we give £1 million to. Kevin, keep fighting. Thank you.
This is Nick Ferrari with more to come as I look back at my week on breakfast. This is LBC. This is Nick Ferrari with a look back at my week on breakfast here on LBC.
Pleased to say I'm joined by Deputy Prime Minister Nick Clegg, of course, leader of the Liberal Democrats, who I believe you're on manoeuvres. Mr Clegg, where are you?
I'm in manoeuvres in St Agnes in Cornwall.
Right.
Yeah.
Just
in
before
the glorious Cornish sunshine.
Just before I go to our first caller, I believe that, isn't that the location for Poldark, Mr Clegg?
I think it might be. I actually haven't watched Poldark. Do you like it? Have you seen it?
I'm aware that vast chunks of the country watch it. Are you going to be ripping your shirt off and diving into the foamy sea later today, la Poldark?
Yes, I am. Yes. Of course I'm not.
we look forward. At least that's a reason for going to St Agnes, I suppose, and some kind of justification. Right, we move straight to the first call I'm there. Now, Paul is in Lichfield. Paul, you're through to Nick Clegg. Go ahead, Paul.
Oh, good morning, Nick and Nick.
Good morning,
hello.
Sir.
Now then, it seems to me that as university tuition fees are in reality a graduate tax, I'd love to know why it is that the Lib Dems aren't saying this loudly and often.
Oh, Paul, you are a man of great wisdom. It is basically a progressive graduate tax that we'd inherited, introduced, and I agree with the implication of your question that if only we'd called it that, it would have saved me certainly quite a lot of heartache, because you're quite right, it is, and the think tanks like the Institute for Fiscal Studies, for instance, have published reports showing how very progressive it is, because you basically only pay when you can pay, you don't pay if you can't, you don't pay if you earn below a certain amount, and you pay more if you earn a lot more. So it really is a progressive graduate tax. The technical reasons why you can't call this particular form of sort of payment and repayment a tax is lost in the mists of time and in the bowels of the Treasury. But I remember 5 years ago pushing very hard, why on earth can't we call this a graduate tax? And there was various pointy-headed reasons why you couldn't. But you're quite right, Paul, this is in effect what we have introduced. And it means, as you know, that someone, let's say, who graduates and earns, I don't know, a graduate starting salary of 24,000, under the old system, they were paying, under the old system introduced by Labour, they were paying about £66 a month. On 24,000. Under the new system, a graduate would pay about £22 a month, so about a third of what it cost. You might have to pay longer, I acknowledge that, but actually someone on that salary, which is just shy of the national average wage, would pay a third less per month than you would under the old system.
Back to you, Paul.
Obviously that's all true. What I'm wishing, and I keep being disappointed about, is that the Lib Dems don't say it.
Well, I say repeatedly, as does Vince Cable, who, as you know, worked very hard to make this system, since we couldn't do what we wanted, that we did the next best thing, got the fairest deal we could get. And Vince also, you know, often, I've heard him say this publicly, say this is in effect a progressive graduate tax. But it isn't a tax in the strictly sort of conventional sense of the word. So certainly at the time, it was not branded as such.
All right, thank you for that, Paul. We move on to other calls. Fred in Enfield, you're through to the Deputy Prime Minister. Go ahead, Fred.
Hello there, Nick. What my question was is, why do we need to employ practitioners with degrees in nursery schools? I can't understand why we need to do that, because what is so difficult teaching 2-year-olds and 3-year-olds to do simple mathematics?
Well, this is, of course, just for my listeners who might not be aware, this is an organisation called Read On, Get On. It's a coalition of charities, parents, teachers and businesses. They've discovered in a report published today the poor quality, as they describe, of early education in England. It's too variable. And they point to the fact that staff, just 13% staff of independent nurseries, and they make up 75% of the total in this country, have a relevant degree. So they're pushing for staff, for people who work in nurseries, to have better education, better attainment and degrees. That's Fred's question. Nick Clegg.
Fred, I don't think they're saying that everybody should have a, you know, I'm being a bit facetious, but not saying that everybody should have a PhD in astrophysics. They're not saying that all should be you know, graduates or this or that. They're saying they should have qualifications. And I think that's not a bad sort of ambition, isn't it? Because you say it's easier. It's not that easy, Fred. It's really, I don't think it is that easy, actually, to make sure that you give proper care to 2, 3 and 4-year-old toddlers before they go to school. And the evidence is quite strong, actually, that the better qualified someone is, and we in government have tried to raise the status of the qualifications attached to early years education, early years provision, the better it is for those little children. And on the much more serious end of the scale, Fred, you know, we have had some instances in recent years where unqualified individuals have really let families down very badly by not protecting and providing the kind of care that little children quite rightly deserve in all early years settings.
Yeah, but you'll find that most early years settings have got people with practitioners with level 2, level 3,
yeah,
level 3 management, and we're also governed, as you know, by Ofsted. If there's anything wrong, they would spot it straight away.
Yeah,
and also the early years team from the borough.
Yeah.
So if someone with a degree, like, okay, perhaps not a degree as you say, but then you've got factoring that people that attend nurseries don't pay for the holidays, that you only pay for when you use a service. So
also
when you factor in, Nick, when you factor in the rent, the rates, the electric, the water, the repairs and renewals, you wouldn't actually make much of a profit. You know, with level threes, you can get by, then level fours perhaps, into management and things like that, yes. But if people are going to come in with degrees, they're going to want £22,000 to £26,000 starting salary. It won't pay.
Yeah. Fred, you sound as if you know a thing or two about this. Do you work in the area?
No, I'm an Ofsted provider.
Are you an Ofsted inspector or?
No, a provider. I run a nursery school.
Oh, you run a nursery? Yeah. And you've done that for some time, have you?
Yeah, well, I actually fund it, to be quite honest with you.
No, I hear what you say, Fred. I mean, you're obviously at the sharp end. I'm not, but, you know, I hear what you say about the fact that your income is often not constant across the year. You've got the 15 hours entitlement for some 2-year-olds and all 3 and 4-year-olds. But you'll know better than I do. You need to earn a lot more over and above that to make something run properly. And it's not the most well-paid sector. I accept all of that, but I think nonetheless what Save the Children and others are saying is, firstly, we've got to keep investing in early years. You can't do this on the cheap, and I strongly, strongly agree with that. And that's why, funny enough, our first caller just now, Paul, was talking about the change in how you finance universities, and in effect we're asking graduates to pay a contribution and not just have it all fall on the shoulders of taxpayers, many of whom haven't gone to university. But at the other end of the education system, in other words, when little children, before they even go to school, we've piled in, as I hope you'll acknowledge, Fred, huge amounts of extra money through the expanded 3 and 4-year-old entitlement, the expanded 2-year-old entitlement. And I think we need to keep that up. And David Laws, as you may know, has introduced this early years pupil premium. So that's money going on top of that to help the early years education of children from the most disadvantaged families. So what they're saying, what Save the Children and others are saying, is keep the money going in. I agree with that. But also make sure that the qualifications are raised over time. Not, you can't do it overnight, are raised over time, because the evidence shows that that's the right thing for kids.
We move to other calls. Hannah in Essex. Hannah.
Yes, hello. I'd like to ask a question about emotional and mental health services. Nick Clegg has demonstrated his commitment to mental health, but the area that concerns me is the kind of first call emotional support helplines run by charities which have been hit, services have been decimated by recent cuts in funding, and that's kind of preventative work. And I'm just wondering, Nick Clegg's response is to that.
Hannah, can you just tell me, have you worked for one of those services where the money's been cut?
Yes, I work for one of those services. This time next month I will be out of a job.
I'm sorry to hear that.
My colleagues have lost their jobs, but this is not great thing. What I'm concerned about is the service users. My service has been cut, but so many others, similar services have.
And Hannah, I'm not inviting you to sort of, I'm just to understand it. Was the money cut from, was it from the clinical commissioning, or is it a NHS decision, or was it a council decision, do you know?
No, it's DfE funding.
DfE?
Yeah.
Right, OK. Well, without obviously knowing the details, I mean, as it happens, the overall amount of money, centrally, that has gone into mental health has gone up, well, for instance, it's gone up to £11.6 billion this year, up from £11.3 billion last year, has gone up. But the way in which that sort of works locally is, and I'm not going to hide from this, is really quite erratic. And some places, frankly, have seen mental health services shortchanged for far too long, because, as you know, individual decisions in individual areas can vary quite a lot. And other areas, mental health funding has been properly passed on from the centre, you know, to organisations on the ground. Now, I think it is changing. I mean, we've put a lot of money, £400 million extra in for talking therapies. As you know, I announced £150 million for eating disorders. I recently announced this very big transformation of child and adolescent mental health services. Yeah. I accept, Hannah, as you know, I make an announcement. It doesn't, you know, there's always this frustrating sometimes time lag between you decide something and actually it happening. But crucially, and I think this is helpful to you, Hannah, if not necessarily to your individual organisation, is that within the NHS, the head of the NHS, Simon Stevens, has been very, very clear to local, you know, commissioners, people who make the funding decisions locally, that they've got to pass on the money that's going in mental health centrally to local organisations. And the way in which mental health trusts are going to be funded is finally being changed so that they get funded on the same sort of method as, say, an acute hospital trust. Because in the past, mental health trusts always were shortchanged because they got this block grant, which was then sort of salami sliced every time any NHS manager needed to make a financial saving. And they've now put it on the same footing as the rest of the NHS. In other words, they get money per, you know, according to the number of individuals and patients they actually help.
I agree with that, but I think the difficulty is that we are targeting acute groups, which is important, and not the preventative work, which you cannot measure.
No.
And who knows what is being prevented by these services? And unfortunately, I think we're going to be caught out by this in a few years when we see what's in the coming up.
This is Nick Ferrari. More highlights of my week on breakfast after the news. This is LBC. This is Nick Ferrari with a look back at my week on breakfast here on LBC.
The multi-million pound Hatton Garden Gems heist gang had an insider who helped them, so police believe. An alarm was triggered when the professional gang broke into the building. It's in the heart of what London now describes as its jewellery district. A security guard is understood to have made a cursory check of the property on Good Friday before leaving when he found nothing untoward. Police refused to say whether officers were dispatched to investigate reports of a possible break-in at Hatton Garden Safe Deposit Limited. Why? How? Hang on. Police refused to say whether. Why? We pay. This isn't going to compromise the investigation. It's not like we're saying, did you spot Arthur Farnsbarnes walking around Hatton Garden on Thursday afternoon at 3 o'clock? I could understand. How dare they refuse to say? Do you know, the way the police treat us now. What was the thing the other day? Damn, I meant to write about it in my column. Sorry, this is real stream of consciousness now. That's right, it was the man who took photographs of two police vehicles in Kingston being chased by an anti-terror unit because they wondered why they were taking pictures. And now police refuse to say whether they answered the call. How dare they? We'll come to that aspect in just a second. Of course, the other thing is that so many people who use this Hatton Garden Safe Deposit Limited company, as of yesterday afternoon, still didn't know whether they were some of the victims. For whatever reason, they were taking so long to actually find out what had happened. LBC reporter Tom Swarbrick has been on this story for a couple of days. What's the latest, Tom?
Curiouser and curiouser, isn't it? There's some stuff we know, a lot we don't, and one suspects, actually, you're right, that the police are actually just as baffled as well. Arthur Farnsbarnes may well be called in. In terms of what we do know, we now know the thieves used the lift shaft from the second floor to abseil into the basement. From there, they went through the shutters and then used a heavy-duty £3,500 drill to get through the 2-metre-thick concrete wall of the vault before then drilling through the locks of around 70 of those safety deposit boxes. The scene inside the vault is total chaos. There's dust, rubble, angle grinders, crowbars, gold bars, jewels, just everywhere. So a difficult job for the police to identify who has lost what. But people's patience is actually now really starting to run thin. There are a lot of angry customers of this company now, particularly given that information about who has lost what has started to leak out to some people, but not to all. The owners of the building are nowhere to be seen. One is in Sudan, the other reportedly in India. The security guard at the centre of this is copping flak for reportedly not checking the vault when an alarm sounded on Bank Holiday Friday. And police say they have not formally identified a suspect, although there is one man who might be able to pull off a heist like this. He is known as the King of Diamonds. He masterminded an armed raid in Knightsbridge in 2009. He will be one person the police will be looking at to work out who did this and how.
And lastly, Tom, what's happening at the site today?
Well, we expect more forensic officers to be going in and out of this building. They've been here for a number of days now and say that it will take a number of these more to go over the scene totally. And as we've seen over the last few days, more customers of this place turn up, register with the police, check that their box may or may not have been tampered with. They're turned away without an answer, a lot of them. And for many of the businesses in Hatton Garden, this is a really, really tough period, because if they have had their things taken, many of them aren't insured. Their insurance was putting it in a box. Have they lost their goods and jewels and wares? But yeah, the chances of getting any insurance back from them, very, very slim for some. So it's a real nervous wait.
And just, I'm nervously asking you one final question because your line's starting to peter out. But just, there's that social media chatter that the fire that was in Kingsway, the suggestion that, and Kingsway, for people who don't know London, is a hop, skip and a small gold chain away, really, from Hatton Garden. The fire could have been started as a distraction because then obviously the police are, and other emergency services, are so busy trying to find out what's happening there. That creates a little bit of time, doesn't it? Now we can start drilling through from underground, upstairs, downstairs, whatever. Any truth to that, or any more chatter about that?
Well, the London Fire Brigade have said that it was started. It wasn't started deliberately, but it's one of these things that the police are actually struggling to rule out, and again points to the fact that perhaps the police aren't much further down the line than the media is in trying to work out how this was done or by whom.
Tom Sorbitt reporting there from Hatton Garden. I note that DCI Detective Chief Inspector Paul Johnson of the Flying Squad said it's organised. People have planned this. Dear God. Don't let that bloke near the media. It's organised. Do you mean somebody didn't just walk by with a £3,500 drill? What am I doing this weekend? I'll drill through and nick all this. But they won't tell us whether a copper... this is outrageous. I can't wait to get Bernard Hogenhauer back in here. I don't know. I suppose it can't be the side of the election, can it? Is that the reality of it? Yeah. He's not allowed, is it? Welcome to broadcasting in the 1950s. Now, what if you are one of the owners of those safe deposit boxes down at London's Hatton Garden? Well, this gentleman is Inhaf Maharouf, who joins me now. Condolences. How frustrating is it for you, Mr. Maharouf?
It's quite frustrating. 2 days now. We are just waiting for further information. The police are still investigating inside. They say yesterday they're going to inform 30 of us, but they called at least 4 or 5 people, I guess. So people are still waiting for their call for further information.
And when you ask of the police, how much longer have I got to wait? Can they give you any indication?
Well, now they just say now the investigation is underway. They can't give any exact time or date. They say they will call as soon as possible. So it's not a really nice thing to do. They at least can call people because they know 70 boxes are broken. They got all the information, so that at least they can call those people and say, okay, these boxes are broken, this time also. It makes other people's life much easier. Otherwise, it's quite stressful. You're getting to work every day.
Of course. Mr. Maharouf, have they indicated when you might get access to the strong room?
Not at the moment, because they say forensics are investigating the whole building to get some DNA. So they're not giving any access to the ground floor. They just say we can go inside and talk to there's a few police officers we can talk to.
And I will appreciate you might not want to answer this, but can you tell me what you had in there?
There's quite a lot, because we are diamond traders. We are diamond merchants.
I see.
We have quite a lot of diamonds. And some very, very important stones and jewelries as well. So it is hundreds and hundreds of thousands of pounds.
Many hundreds of thousands of pounds. And are you covered insurance-wise?
Yeah, we are business. We are limited company, so we are all covered. But actually, we don't know what is inside, to be honest. We put most of the things
Yes.
So if police says, obviously if it's broken, I wish it not happen.
Yes.
I can work out with my previous, my accountant and see what inside and give more information for the police.
Yes, indeed. Well, listen, thank you for coming. Perhaps we can stay in touch with you. Perhaps we could arrange to speak to you on Monday to see whether you learn any more over the weekend. And I hope, obviously, for your business and your colleagues, you do. And I hope, indeed, that yours isn't one of the boxes affected. That's Inhaf Maharouf, who has one of those safe deposits and is a diamond trader and jeweller down at Hatton Garden. Jean's in Eltham. Jean, what you say this is like a movie. Which movie was that, then?
Hello, yes, good morning. It's very reminiscent of a very old French film called Rififi back in the 60s. They made some wonderful French films in those days. And the villains involved were, they penetrated the premises by boring down from the floor above into the ceiling, and then they gained access to the whole area. And it was absolutely gripping, and I'm surprised that nobody else has heard of it. I'm sure I'm not the only one who saw that film.
Do you know, there was another film, and it stars Ray Winston, and
that's more recent. Yeah,
yeah, he's in a swimming pool in his villa in Spain, and they drill into somewhere, they go through water, someone help me.
Yeah.
And Ben Kingsley's in it, so Ben, sir, we have to call him Sir Ben Kingsley. And the movie's called Lucky... No, it's not. Rififi. I shall look that up, Jean. It sounds a great movie. Who was in it? Can you recall?
I can't remember.
No,
I'm
Rififi.
Old, but I can't,
no, you're not old, Jean. Do not say
it,
such
it was
nonsense.
A French film. There was no dialogue during the times that they were doing that, and it was absolutely gripping. It was obviously black and white, and it was in the 60s, and it was French, and obviously with
Jean.
Subtitles. But
Jean.
R-I-F-I-F-I, Rififi.
And I've got two things to say to you.
What?
Sexy Beast.
Oh, that's what they all tell me.
No, that's the name of the film with Ray Winston, actually, that was said. I know what you were thinking. That was the name of the film that I was trying to get at. Rififi and Sexy Beast, Jean, thank you. Marilyn is in... Oh, in Mayfair. Good morning, Marilyn. What are you going to tell me?
Good morning, Nick. There was a book which was better than the film, 11 Harrow House Street.
Oh, yes.
And it was all about digging in Hatton Garden...
Yes, yeah.
About 40 years ago.
Ah, do you know, here we go, Brett in Balham. No one's thought to mention the 80s movie 11 Harrow House. Brilliant film about an inside job on a diamond merchant set in Berkeley Square, says Brett. Is that the...
It was in Berkeley Square. It was 11 Harrow House.
Can we look at... Okay, I'm just looking at one of the team talking about... Sorry, was this a TV movie or a general release movie?
It was a general release movie.
General release movie. Okay, who was in it? Do you recall?
Very good. I can't remember.
All right, don't worry. Listen, thank you. We're getting the details up now. Ping them over, team, as soon as you can, please. While I talk. Thank you, Marilyn. Bob's in Tooting. Bob?
Yeah, morning, Ed.
Hello, Gov.
What I think the police should do, they should have a look on Amazon and see who has recently ordered multiple copies of, certainly, Sexy Beast. I've not heard of this Harrow House movie, but that one as well. Because
what?
They would almost certainly have wanted to make sure all the gang saw the film. So I'd look at people who've ordered multiple copies. You know, it might give them a lead.
Right. OK. Well, I have to say, the police, what was it they said? It's obviously a planned job. Get away. Really? You people don't wander around with a 77-pound drill in Hatton Garden all day long. Bob, it's an idea. Thank you. Perhaps a serving police officer. Peter's in Bermondsey. You're on the radio, Peter.
Good morning, Nick. Yeah,
yes,
the lady talking about Rififi.
Yes.
It's the only film ever made. It's 36 minutes, I think, where there was no dialogue whatsoever. And
what, for 36 minutes?
36 minutes.
So what's on it? Just music?
No, there's nothing. There's no sound at all.
For 36... Come on, Tim, we need these films. Why can't we get... Come on, I need to see this. Come on, let's go. Yeah, sorry, I'm talking to someone else then. We just don't seem to be moving very quickly.
The reason for it is they wanted to keep the noise to a minimum. They knocked a little hole, and then they put a umbrella through, and as the bits and pieces fell on it, they lowered the umbrella down.
Right. Who was in it?
Jean Gabon. I don't know who the others were now. He was a major actor at the time. And there was also a film called Wages of Fear.
What?
You can get... Yeah,
right.
And I think the Americans remade that and balls that one up. They balls up Rififi. But at the time, I was saying to the lady, that in the 50s and the early 60s, the French made fabulous films.
Okay.
And there was one man called Fernandel.
Yeah.
And he had a boat race like you couldn't believe it.
Okay.
And
it
was all farce.
Okay.
Very saucy, brilliant films.
All right, sir. Listen, thank you. I'll get Rififi in a moment. Here we are. 11 Harrow House is a 1974 British film. What's this? Wikipedia. Directed by Aram Avakian. Adapted by Charles Grodin. He's an actor, isn't he? based on the novel by Gerald A. Brown. It stars Charles Grodin, Candice Bergen, James Mason. Trevor Howard and John Gielgud. And the plot synopsis is, in England, a small-time diamond merchant is unexpectedly offered the chance to supervise the purchase and cutting of an extremely large diamond to be named for its wealthy owner. When the diamond is stolen from him, he's blackmailed into pulling off a major heist at the Cistern, located at 11 Harrow House, with the help of his beautiful and wealthy girlfriend. That's from Wikipedia.
This is Nick Ferrari with more to come as I look back at my week on breakfast. This is LBC.
Travel Pack.
This is Nick Ferrari with a look back at my week on breakfast here on LBC.
Someone who played in 64 tests as a leg spinning all-rounder, captained Australia to world dominance in the 50s, but to me as a young lad growing up and following the sport, and genuinely, I'm not making this up, listening to him at the back of the religious sciences or religious studies class as I listened to him commentate on England versus Australia cricket matches, and for so many millions of people around the world, Richie Benaud was truly the voice of cricket.
Good morning and welcome to VFL Park Melbourne. It's the first day of the opening super test of the series.
I don't think I've ever seen anything quite like this before, and I've been fiddling around with the game for quite some time.
The sound of summer will never be the same, whether it was with the ball in hand,
and the crowd were electrified as Beno takes a remarkable diving catch to dismiss wickets,
or a microphone.
Australia began the second day of the final test match at 13 for 2.
Richie Beno's command of cricket was, well, simply brilliant.
You are an outstanding cricketer. Play well, but the most important thing is enjoy it every time you put the shot.
Born at the foot of the Blue Mountains in Penrith, Richie grew up in Parramatta and learnt much of his cricket from his father. It wasn't long before the youngster was strong enough to represent New South Wales, first as a batsman. But it was as a leg spin bowler, Richie Beno's career as a cricketer will always be remembered, running in with that trademark open shirt. Richie earned his baggy green in 1952, the first of 63 test caps in which he took 248 wickets, a record in its day. With the bat, he made more than 2,200 runs, scoring 3 centuries and 9 50s. A genuine all-rounder who became the first player to complete the test double of more than 2,000 runs and 200 wickets. Richie Beno was even more solid as Australia's captain, leading his side on 28 occasions and not once losing a series as skipper. He loved his cricket and cricket loved him.
Very nice thought, but bigamy is out on question.
First thing I want to say is that I like it.
When he retired in 1964, he became a full-time sports journalist and broadcaster. Working for the BBC in the UK and Channel 9 here in Australia, Richie didn't see a winter for years. Calling more than 500 test matches, that cream jacket was known the world over as a trademark of quality cricket commentary. His wisdom and knowledge modestly exceeding all.
In acknowledging the great contribution that Richie has made to cricket not only in this country but around the world. Richie, our thanks and best wishes.
A moving tribute there from his long-term employer, Channel 9 in Australia. And let's go to Australia now. Anthony Pinshaw is cricket writer for foxsports.com.au, as in Australia. In Australia, joins me now. How is the country reacting, Anthony?
Nick, it's a bit of a somber mood. I mean, as you said, a lot of us over here grew up with him being sort of the voice of summer. So to think that no one else is going to have that chance is a little bit of a sobering thought, but it's also a bit of a celebration of Richie's life and his career.
I understand the offer of a state funeral from the Prime Minister.
Yeah, that's right. Tony Abbott released a statement today and put forward that offer of a state funeral. Which he did the same for Philip Hughes at the start of this summer. And, I mean, if this offer was to be accepted, it would be an enormous turnout on the streets of Sydney, because he was genuinely loved throughout the entire country by sports lovers, non-sports lovers, cricket fans, just anyone who encountered him, whether it was on TV or on radio, in person. Just had not a bad word to say about Richie.
Absolutely right, and not just loved across Australia, loved right around the world. I had to say, I had the pleasure of meeting him twice, and don't take this the wrong way, but for such a competitive Australian sportsman, he was a very self-effacing bloke, wasn't he, Anthony?
Yeah, absolutely. And in contrast to a lot of his Australian contemporaries, he was not particularly parochial, especially when it came to his commentary. He never wanted to say we or us or them. He was neutral in everything that he did. And exactly, he was self-effacing. He was modest down to a T. He was always calm and collected on the field and off it. And that's what made him universally loved, as you said, not just here but overseas. And even not just in the UK, in India, subcontinent, New Zealand, wherever he went, he was much loved.
Absolutely. Anthony, thanks for coming on. Sorry, it's such a grim subject we're talking about. Anthony Pinshaw, your cricket writer for foxsports.com.au. Richie Beno there, the first man to score 2,000 runs and take 200 wickets at Test level. His first commentary on BBC Radio came in 1960. He was on TV 3 years later. He was diagnosed with skin cancer back in 2005, I think it was. He was receiving intensive care since November. He was admitted to a Sydney hospice on Thursday. Died in his sleep, surrounded by his wife Daphne and other family members. Died aged 84. There won't be many like him again, I can assure you. So it's time for your finger on the mutton. Just to remind you, the day the election was called, four little lambs were born up in, I think it was Bedfordshire. They were selected and they have been named. You can check this out on lbc.co.uk. There are pictures of them. lbc.co.uk. And then they're sprayed with their initials in the colours of their respective four big parties, Conservative, UKIP, Lib Dem and Labour. And the dye that's used has been checked. It is safe. They're not hurt in any way. And we're not eating the lambs, as was thought with some emails. I just want to know what's going to be the fattest on the day before the election, because, of course, there we are, we can tell we're at the farm. We're going to the farm in just a second. We're not allowed to talk about the election or do anything on the day off, so they've got until May the 6th to fatten up. So we've had a week and a bit of full campaigning. LBC's reporter Simon Conway has donned his Wellington boots, and he's down on the farm. So give us the story of the lambs.
Good morning, Nick, again from Watergate Farm in Bedfordshire, where I'm currently looking at David, Ed, Nick and Nigel, who are in a very, very cute huddle. At the moment, it looks like it's going to be a coalition of all four parties. I think that is unlikely. Alice is from the farm. Alice, how have they been getting on?
They've been great fun. They're getting very friendly and constantly competing for everybody's attention.
And who has been, before we get onto the weights, who has been standing out?
Well, we've got four very different personalities. Ed seems very happy just to sit back, let the others compete, and he'll sort of slide in at the end. Probably David and Nick seem very strong characters, always at the front of the pen, you know, wanting anybody to give them a stroke as they walk past.
Excellent. Well, let's get on to the big reveal now, the weight difference from last week to this week. In last place, we have Nick, who was 3.5 kilos last week and now weighs 4.5 kilos, so he's put on a kilo.
Okay, hold on then one second, Simon. Ed. Just to give that in pounds. So 3.5 is 7.5 pounds. And you say he's gone up to what, 4.5, did you say?
He's 4.5.
He's 4.5 now, and I can tell you that is, excuse me, that's almost 10 pounds. So there's 10 pounds of Nick Clegg. On we go.
Okay, after that, we have Ed, who was 3.4 kilos last week and is now 4.5.
Oh, OK, so he's roughly the same. So he's about 10 pounds as well. There's 10 pounds of Ed Miliband. Second place.
Yep. Second place, Nigel, who last week was 3.6 and is now a whopping 5.5.
Well, let's just put that in. 5.5 equals over 12 pounds. So he's a big beast, but I sense there's one even bigger.
But just a smidgen, Nick, just a smidgen. Leading the pack is David, who last week also 3.6 and now 5.6 kilos.
5.6 kilos, which is virtually 12.5 pounds. So he's a whopper of a lamb there. As you get to know them, Simon, describe just briefly the personalities of the four lambs. As you make your way out to Watergate Farm, who are you looking forward to chatting or seeing most?
Well, I have to say, Nick, as I came off air last week with you, we went outside and took a few pictures with them on the grass, and Nick was definitely the one that warmed to me the most. He took a liking to my leg, and I can say that this week, not much has changed in that week at all. He remembered me instantly and came up to me and barred incessantly. So I'm very much looking forward to spending more time with Nick.
And pictures on the LBC website later today, presumably. Will there be fresh pictures and video and goodness knows what else?
Yes, I've taken a lovely little video this morning of them all being fed at the same time. And you can take a look for yourself at the increase in size and weight.
Now, earlier in the show, I asked you, what do you get if you put together a fog of dust particles making its way from Paris and other parts of France, it has to be said. Local air pollution as well, a little bit of heat, and perhaps not a lot of movement, and, of course, the traffic fumes. You get an ugly smog that could plague much of London and the South East, the M25 area. So we decided to find out just how bad it was by deploying LBC's breakfast reporter Simon Conway in London's Green Park. Now, young Simon is a keen runner. He's done, or is about to do, his first marathon. So just running was not enough. We gave him a special mask that would measure the level of pollution that he had to endure. And he also had to avail himself of a young woman, a small child or a jockey and give me a 1,000-metre run. What happened next? Simon!
Good morning, Nick. Well, shortly after you left me, I came across Gabriella, who was going for her morning run, daring the conditions here in Green Park. She's 5'2", agreed to jump on my back, and here's what happened over the next 1,000 metres.
Right. I've got Gabriella on my back.
Yep, let's go.
Right.
Let's do it. Come on, Simon, you can do it. I know you can. Oh, Lord. Oh, God, look at that.
Mum.
I don't know about this.
Was the mic on? Just taking the mask off. Yeah. And there's a big patch on the filter showing where the pollution particles have gone, where they've avoided going into my mouth. I tell you what, though. That was really, really difficult. You can really tell that it's really high levels of pollution here today. The advice is right. Don't run.
With a woman on your back. Simon joins me now. So, how far did you run, Mr. Conway?
I think it was 1,000 metres. Gabriella was measuring it because I was I had a number of other things on my mind. She was measuring the distance.
It was 1,000 metres, was it, Mr. Conway?
Well, I'm going by my sources, yes.
Yeah, because we timed that, Mr. Conway, and that came in at about 1 minute 40 seconds.
So I told you I'm a fast runner, Nick. I'm a very, very fast runner.
1,000 metres in 1 minute 40, you're in the wrong game, my son. You should be out there for the Olympic team.
Mo Farah, watch out. That's all I have to say.
The experiment, never try and kid a kidder. I remind you that, Simon, never kid a kidder. But well done, young man. You accomplished yourself well. You found, and thank you to Gabriella, who jumped on your back. Take care. We've had a laugh. It is dangerous out there this weekend if you have got people who are vulnerable or indeed elderly. Perhaps you want to care a little bit of extra care for them over the weekend.
I'm Nick Ferrari. You've been listening to the highlights of my week at breakfast on LBC. I'm back on Monday leading Britain's conversation with the big breaking stories of the day, along with regular travel updates. Have a great weekend and stay safe. This is LBC.